Welcome to Historical Nerdery, the show that destroys the myths of the American Revolution one podcast at a time. I am your head nerd, Alexander Kane. On today's episode, The Decisive Day Has Come. We'll discuss the pivotal battle of June 17th, 1775, the Battle of Bunker Hill. I hope you will join us today on Historical Nerdery. Let's get into the show. The Siege of Boston can be divided into three overlapping categories. The first was organizational and addressed the efforts to organize the Continental Army surrounding Boston and ensure it was properly supplied. The second addressed the American interdiction efforts on land and sea that were designed to deny vital supplies to the British troops and civilians trapped inside the town. The final category focused on the American military efforts to envelop Boston. This final phase essentially started with the Battle of Bunker Hill and ended with the British evacuation of Boston on March 17, 1776. The Battle of Bunker Hill was fought on June 17, 1775, and was the third Massachusetts military engagement of the American Revolution. In the days leading up to the engagement, British commanders realized that the Charlestown Peninsula, located north of Boston, and Dorchester Heights to the south, commanded the town and its harbor. If the American forces seized either or both of the hills, His Majesty's troops would be forced to abandon Boston. As a result, General Thomas Gage, commander of the British Army, met with Major Generals William Howe, Henry Clinton, and John Burgoyne to discuss potential options. The officers quickly concluded that they should move to seize both hills before the rebels did. As General Burgoyne noted, it was absolutely necessary to become masters of these heights. The original military plan called for a complex and coordinated strike against the American siege lines, as well as Bunker Hill and Dorchester Heights. General Howe was placed in command of an amphibious operation, while Generals Burgoyne and Clinton would attack by land. However, on June 15th, the leaders of the colonial forces besieging Boston learned of the proposed British operation. In response, American forces formulated their own plan, which called for the tightening of the encirclement of Boston by seizing Dorchester Heights and Bunker Hill. The next morning, General Artemus Ward, commander of the New England forces, ordered Colonel William Prescott, with the aid of 1,000 colonial troops, to take and fortify Bunker Hill. Prescott was a native of Groton, Massachusetts, and a veteran of the French and Indian Wars. According to the colonel, he received orders the evening of June 16, 1775, to take his regiment, as well as Colonel Bridges and Colonel Fry's regiments, and a detachment of Connecticut troops under the command of Israel Putnam to fortify Bunker Hill. Prescott and his troops arrived at Charlestown Peninsula that same night. Curiously, Prescott and the other officers held a council of war and ultimately decided to bypass Bunker Hill, situated near the only route back to Cambridge, and instead gave orders to march to Breed's Hill, a smaller mound further south and within cannon range of Boston and the British Royal Navy in the harbor. Historians to this day have been trying to piece together what happened during the Council of War that Prescott held, and it remains a mystery why they decided to build their entrenchments on the lower hill. Some historians speculate that because Breed's Hill was closer to Boston and His Majesty's forces, it would be even more likely to force a military confrontation. However, by positioning troops on Breed's Hill, the Americans risked being cut off by British warships that controlled both Boston Harbor and the mouth of the Charles River. Regardless of the reasons behind the decision, the provincials advanced to Breed's Hill and began to dig in. According to Prescott, "We arrived at the spot the lines were drawn by the engineer, and we began the entrenchment about 12 o'clock, implying the work with all possible expedition. The New England troops toiled throughout the night, and by early morning constructed an earthen fort 160 feet long and 30 feet high and with breastworks. Adjacent to the redoubt was a pre-existing rail fence that ran down towards the Mystic River. At dawn, lookouts on the British Royal Navy warships and sentries inside Boston quickly noticed the new redoubt constructed within cannon range of Boston. In response, the Royal Navy and Royal Artillery opened fire. Cannon fire directed upon the fortification quickly awoke the town and countryside. As Prescott recalled, just before sun rising, when the enemy began a very heavy cannonading and bombardment, in the interim, The engineer forsook me, having thrown up a small redoubt, found it necessary to draw a line about 20 rods in the length from the fort, northerly, under a very warm fire from the enemy's artillery. Militiaman Peter Brown, who served in Prescott's regiment, would later recall, "The danger we were in made us think there was treachery and that we were brought there to be all be slain. About 5 in the morning, we not having more than half our fort done, they began to fire pretty briskly for a few minutes, then ceased, but soon begun again, and fired to the number of 20 minutes. They killed but one of our men, then ceased to fire till about 11 o'clock, when they began to fire as brisk as ever." As the morning wore on, British warships continued to bombard the American troops as they worked on their redoubt. The men inside the redoubt atop Breed's Hill were understandably anxious. They were thirsty, hungry, and tired. They expected fresh troops from Cambridge to relieve them of their duty so they could retire to a safe location behind friendly lines. According to one period account, the men worked exceedingly hard all night and no refreshment had been sent them of any kind, that they were almost suffocated with dust and choked for want of liquor. They expected to have been relieved early in the morning, but no relief came, and to add to their distress, they found the regulars preparing to pay them a visit. Peter Brown noted, "We began to be almost beat out, being fatigued by our labor, having no sleep the night before, very little to eat, we grew faint, thirsty, hungry, and weary. The enemy fired very warm from Boston and from on board their ships, which caused many of our young country people to desert, apprehending the danger in a clearer manner than others who were more diligent in digging and fortifying ourselves against them." According to local tradition, in an effort to inspire his men and improve morale, Colonel Prescott exposed himself to enemy fire and calmly walked along the top of the redoubt wall. Meanwhile, back in Boston, General Gage summoned a council of war. Understandably, their earlier planned military operation to attack both Dorchester Heights and Bunker Hill was cast aside. When the British generals met to discuss their options, General Clinton urged an attack as early as possible and suggested the assault begin from the Charlestown Neck that would cut off the colonists' retreat from Breed's Hill. However, he was outvoted by the other three generals, who were concerned that his plan violated the rule to not allow one's army to become trapped between enemy forces. Howe was of the opinion that the hill was open and of easy ascent, and in short would be easily carried. General Burgoyne concurred, arguing that the untrained rabble would be no match for their trained troops. Orders were then issued to prepare the expedition. General Burgoyne noted, "On the 17th, at dawn of the day, we found the enemy had pushed entrenchments with great diligence during the night on the heights of Charlestown, and we evidently saw that every hour gave them fresh strength. It was therefore became necessary to alter our plan and to attack on that side." Following the Council of War, British forces sprung into action. According to one eyewitness, Royal Navy transport boats were hurrying about with great velocity. In Cambridge, General Ward was notified that the enemy was preparing for an assault against the American position. In response, he ordered, without delay, several regiments down to their assistance. Among the first regiments to respond were those from New Hampshire and under the command of Colonel John Stark. As the men approached Charlestown Neck, a narrow strip of land connecting Cambridge to Charlestown and the rebel positions, the 20-gun HMS Lively began to rake the position with artillery fire. As other American regiments scrambled for cover or cowered in fear, Colonel Stark ordered his men to continue across the neck. Miraculously, no one was hurt. When the New Hampshire men arrived at Breed's Hill, Stark surveyed the ground and immediately saw that the British would probably try to flank the rebels by landing on the beach of the Mystic River, which was located below and to the left of Bunker Hill. Stark led his men to the low ground between Mystic Beach and the hill and ordered them to fortify the rail fence by stuffing straw and grass between the rails. Stark also noticed an additional gap in the defensive line between the rail fence and the shore and ordered Lieutenant Nathaniel Hutchins and others to follow him down a 9-foot-high bank to the edge of the water. They proceeded to pile rocks across the 12-foot-wide beach to form a crude defensive line. After this fortification was hastily constructed, Stark deployed his men 3 deep behind the wall and the rail fence. Local tradition and secondary sources suggest that prior to the commencement of the fight, Colonel Stark placed stakes approximately 100 feet in front of the fence and ordered not to fire until the regulars passed them. Elements of other regiments also risked the dangers of the Royal Navy artillery fire, crushed Charlestown Neck, and reinforced the American positions. These troops included portions of the Massachusetts regiments of Colonels Brewer, Nixon, Woodbridge, Little, Moore, as well as Callender's Company of Artillery. One volunteer who arrived to support the American cause was the president of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress and a recently appointed Major General, Joseph Warren. Upon arrival, Colonel Prescott offered Warren command of the field. Surprisingly, he declined the offer, deferring to the military experience of Prescott and Putnam. As American forces struggled to shore up their defenses, the Committee of Safety dispatched alarm riders to the countryside. The riders quickly spread the news that a battle had commenced and that the militia companies would be needed to help stem the British tide should they break through the American positions on Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill. The Bunker Hill alarm, as it became known, reached Essex, Middlesex, and Norfolk counties in the afternoon of June 17th. Among those militia companies that responded to the Bunker Hill alarm was Captain John Parker's Lexington Company. Despite reeling from the events of April 19, 1775, Captain Parker ordered the Lexington Militia Company to assemble and personally led 64 men to Cambridge to assist in the cause. Between midday and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the first wave of British troops began to cross over from Boston and land in Charlestown. They assembled out of musket range and awaited for a second wave of troops to land. General Howe anticipated sending his force in two thrusts. One force, under the command of Brigadier General Robert Pigott, would advance on the redoubt as a feint, while the second, under the command of Howe, would march to the right through an open pasture and flank, surround, and crush the American forces inside the redoubt. Major John Pitcairn of the Marines was placed in command of a reserve force. As Howe prepared to launch his attack, American militiamen took up sniper positions in the homes, barns, and warehouses inside Charlestown, and opened fire on Brigadier General Pigott's troops. As casualties began to mount, General Howe requested that the Royal Navy suppress the sniper fire. Admiral Graves, who had planned for such a possibility, ordered hot shot and incendiary bombs fired into the village, and then sent a landing party to burn Charlestown to the ground. As General Burgoyne observed, straight before us a large and noble town in one great blaze, the church steeples being of timber, were great pyramids of fire above the rest. A later broadside, which announced the aftermath of the Battle of Bunker Hill, described the fate of Charlestown and its residents. The town was wantonly and inhumanely set on fire and consumed previous to the engagement. This town contained one large meeting house, about 300 dwelling houses, a great number of which were large and elegant, besides 150 or 200 other buildings, whereby about 600 or 700 of its distressed inhabitants are now forced from their dwellings and obliged to seek new habitations for themselves, many of whom having left on this terrible occasion their houses, clothes, furniture, and everything in short that was valuable, depend at this time entirely on the benevolent charity of their kind and sympathizing brethren and friends in this country. As the bombardment of Charlestown and the American positions continued, many residents of nearby towns climbed to hills and rooftops to watch the events unfold. Abigail Adams and her 8-year-old son, John Quincy Adams, watched the engagement from a hilltop in Braintree. 22 miles to the north, residents of Andover, Massachusetts, watched from Holt Hill as Charlestown burned. Due to over a century of deforestation, residents as far north as Exeter, New Hampshire, and Newburyport, Massachusetts, could hear the British artillery bombardments of the American position on Breed's Hill. In Boston, General Burgoyne noted, "Behind us the church steeples and the heights of our own camp, covered with spectators of the rest of our army which was not engaged, the hills round the country covered with spectators, the roar of cannons, mortars, and musketry, the crush of churches and whole streets falling together in ruin, to fill the ear, the storm of the redoubts, with the objective above described to fill the eye, and the reflection that perhaps a defeat was a final loss to the British Empire in America to fill the mind, made the whole picture in a complication of horror and importance before anything that ever came to my lot to be witnessed to. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, over 2,000 British soldiers had landed and were ready to attack the American positions. When Howe finally launched his attack, he had hoped artillery crews he had brought over with his forces would provide cover for their assault. However, it was soon discovered that these cannons had been supplied with the wrong caliber of ammunition, thereby rendering them useless during the first assault. Nevertheless, General Howe led the light infantry companies and grenadiers in the attack on the American left flank along the rail fence, expecting an easy effort against Stark's recently arrived troops. His light infantry advanced along the narrow beach in column formation in an effort to turn the far left flank of the colonial position. The grenadiers were deployed to the left of Howe and advanced towards the rail fence. Pigott led the 5th, 38th, 43rd, 47th, and 52nd regiments, as well as the Marines, as they advanced towards the redoubt. From the American position, militiamen leveled their fowling pieces and military muskets slowly, took aim at the enemy, and waited. Many historians point to the alleged order given to the American troops to hold their fire until they see the whites of their eyes. It is uncertain as to who said it, if at all. Some historians claim it was Putnam, others say it was Stark, many others point to Prescott. However, other historians suggest that the phrase was a fabrication by early 19th century historians. Whether or not this order was actually said at the Battle of Bunker Hill, it was clear that the colonial military leadership did order their troops to hold their fire until the very last moment when it would have the greatest effect, especially given the situation that they had a limited supply of ammunition. Furthermore, the phrase "don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes" did not originate at the Battle of Bunker Hill. As historian John Bell has correctly pointed out, holding fire for that long was said to be a tradition of the Royal Navy. According to newspaper accounts found by Bell from the 1750s, Royal Navy officers repeatedly ordered their men to hold their fire until they could see the whites of their enemy's eyes. As the British forces advanced on the American position, they were not prepared for the array of difficulties that faced them. The hay on the hillside had not been harvested, requiring that the regulars march through waist-high grass, which concealed the uneven terrain beneath them. According to research conducted by Boston National Historical Park, hidden beneath the matured hay and grass was a web of stone walls, rail fences, hedges, ditches, holes, and even a marsh of unknown proportions. The stone walls and fences could not be easily disassembled, thereby forcing British soldiers to climb over them and slow their advance. General Burgoyne would later complain, "Howe's disposition was exceedingly soldier-like. In my opinion, it was perfect. As his first arm advanced up the hill, they met with 1,000 impediments from strong fences and were much exposed." At the head of Howe's light infantry column was His Majesty's 23rd Regiment of Foot, also known as the Royal Welch Fusiliers. As the light infantrymen from the regiment advanced along the shoreline towards Stark's position, the New Hampshire men crouched low to the ground and waited until the advancing British were almost on top of them. And then they stood up and fired as one. They unleashed a fierce and unexpected volley directly into the faces of the Fusiliers. The deadly volley swept through their ranks, killing and wounding over 90 men almost instantaneously. The unexpected volley broke the light column's advance, and the surviving men panicked, broke, and fled from the field. Behind the 23rd Regiment of Foot was a light infantry company composed of men from the 4th Regiment of Foot, also known as the King's Own Regiment. The 4th Foot attempted to rush forward and tried to scramble over and around the dead and wounded Fusiliers. This charge was futile, as it was also decimated by a withering fusillade from Stark's men. Quickly, the remainder of the light infantry broke and retreated from the field. Howe's grenadiers to his left were not faring better either. They too were cut down by a barrage of musket fire, and at the height of the attack, James Abercrombie, commanding the grenadiers, was fatally wounded. Pigott's attack on the redoubt and breastwork suffered a similar fate. From a vantage point in Boston, 10-year-old Loyalist Dorothea Gamsby watched as Pigott's forces advanced against the Americans' position. According to Gamsby, the glittering host, the crashing music, all the pomp and brilliance of war moved on up toward that band of rebels. But still they labored at their entrenchment. They seemed to take no heed. The bullets from the ships, the advancing column of British warriors, every available window and roof was filled with anxious spectators, watching the advancing regulars. Every heart, I dare say, throbbed as mine did, as we held our breath, or rather, it seemed to stop and oppress the laboring chests of its own accord, so intensely as we awaited the expected attack. But the troops drew nearer and nearer, and the rebels toiled on. At length, one who stood conspicuously above the rest waved his bright weapon. The explosion came, attended by the crash, the shrieks of the wounded and the groans of the dying. My aunt fainted. I screamed with all my might. Pigott halted his forces before the redoubt and attempted to return fire with the colonists. As a result, his men were fully exposed and suffered heavy losses. At the same time, his soldiers continued to be harried by snipers inside of Charlestown as it continued to burn. After learning of Howe's fate, Pigott ordered a retreat. Shouts of huzzas erupted from the American positions as His Majesty's forces withdrew from the field. Howe quickly met with his officers and ordered a second assault of the American position. This time, Pigott was to assault the redoubt directly while Howe would lead an attack against the rail fence. The regulars reformed on the field and marched out again, this time not only having to navigate a field strewn with obstacles, but with dead and wounded comrades as well. Once again, the American forces held their fire until His Majesty's troops came within almost point-blank range. Along the rail fence, Connecticut troops under the command of Charles Knowlton were ordered to hold their fire until the enemy came within 15 rods of their position. Inside the redoubt, Prescott also ordered his men to hold their fire. Inside Boston, civilian spectators continued to watch as British troops once again ascended the hill. Suddenly, there was a large orange flash like a continual sheet of lightning along the earthworks, followed by an uninterrupted peal of thunder. Once again, rebel fire tore into the ranks of the regulars. According to Prescott, the enemy advanced and fired very hotly on the fort. In meeting with a warm reception, there was a very smart firing on both sides. After a considerable time, finding our ammunition was almost spent, I commanded a cessation till the enemy advanced within 30 yards, when we gave them such a hot fire that they were obliged to retire nearly 150 yards before they could rally and come again to the attack. Howe's forces were cut down before the rail fence, as one British officer would sadly report. Most of our grenadiers and light infantry, the moment of presenting themselves, lost 3/4 and many 9/10 of their men. Some had only 8 or 9 men a company left. It was too much to endure, and the British troops once again broke and ran from the field. Once out of the musket fire range, British forces began to ferry their wounded back to Boston. Loyalist Dorothea Gamsby witnessed the carnage of the battle firsthand. According to the child, by and by, drays, carts, and every description of vehicle that could be obtained were seen nearing the scene of conflict, and the roar of artillery ceased. Then came the loads of wounded men, attended by the long lines of soldiers, a sight to be remembered. There was nothing but woe and sorrow and shame to be found in the reality. After much debate and argument with his staff officers, General Howe ordered his troops to assault the American position a third time, a concentrated bayonet charge against the redoubt. Prior to launching the assault, Howe sent word to General Clinton in Boston for additional troops. Clinton, who had observed the first two attacks with Burgoyne, sent around 400 men from the 2nd Marines and the 63rd Regiment of Foot, and followed himself to help rally the troops. In addition to these reserves, he convinced around 200 walking wounded to form up for a third attack. Meanwhile, inside the redoubt and along the rail fence, men were rejoicing at their success. However, the celebration was short-lived as the American troops faced three distinct issues. They had received very little support in the form of reinforcements from the American main army. Men inside the redoubt and along the rail fence were exhausted and were deserting and abandoning their post in large numbers. Worst of all, they were almost out of ammunition. General Ward desperately tried to funnel troops to shore up the American position. However, most regiments either refused or were incapable of crossing Charlestown Neck due to the continuous bombardment of it by the Royal Navy. At least one regimental commander did little to distinguish himself. Samuel Gerrish's 25th Massachusetts Regiment had arrived at the Charlestown Neck shortly after the first assault on Breed's Hill. The battalion immediately came under heavy fire. As Major Loamy Baldwin recalled, "I went with the recruits, and there was a great number of cannon shots struck near me, but they were not suffered to hurt me. Upon seeing the narrow roadway being raked from both sides by British warships, Colonel Gerrish was overcome with fear. A tremor seized Gerrish. He began to bellow, 'Retreat, retreat, or you will all be cut off,' which so confused and scared the men that they retreated quickly. Moments later, Connecticut's Israel Putnam arrived on the scene, fresh from the fight and intent on leading reinforcements back to the American position. He found Colonel Gerrish prostrate on the ground, declaring that he was exhausted. Putnam pleaded with Gerrish to lead his troops onto the field. Finding both the colonel as well as most of the regiment unresponsive, Putnam resorted to threats and violence. He cursed and threatened the men, and even struck some of them with the flat of his sword in an attempt to drive them across the neck. Only the regimental adjutant and a handful of men who rallied around him crossed over the neck, climbed Bunker Hill, and moved forward to take up a defensive position on Breed's Hill. The remainder of the regiment scattered and fled back towards Cambridge, where they remained for the rest of the day. As Howe's men advanced towards the redoubt, they were once again met with a heavy volley of musket fire. However, subsequent firings became ragged and started to sputter. When the Americans ran out of powder, they began to hurl rocks and sod at their assailants. Realizing that the Americans were now defenseless, the British troops let out a blood-curdling roar and rushed the redoubt walls. Prescott would later note, "Our ammunition, being nearly exhausted, could keep up only a scattering fire. The enemy, being numerous, surrounded our little fort, began to mount our lines, and enter the fort with their bayonets. We was obliged to retreat through them while they kept up as hot a fire as it was possible for them to make. We, having very few bayonets, could make no resistance." One of the last British casualties as the battle came to a conclusion was Major John Pitcairn, the Marine who had fought at the Battle of Lexington. The Marine was allegedly shot by a black soldier. Competing local traditions credit either Salem Poor of Andover, Massachusetts, or Peter Salem of Framingham, Massachusetts, as the shooter. As Pitcairn lay dying on the battlefield, his final words returned to the engagement that started the American Revolution. Pitcairn again spoke of the Battle of Lexington and insisted the rebels started the fight. As British soldiers and Marines mounted the walls, they engaged in a bloody hand-to-hand fight inside the redoubt. Any colonist that was able to flee ran as quickly as possible out of the redoubt as British soldiers pursued them. In a letter to his mother, militiaman Peter Brown described his mental state as he fled from the redoubt. "When the arrows of death flew thick around me, I was preserved while others were suffered to fall a prey to our cruel enemies. Oh, may that God, whose mercy was so far extended in my preservation, grant me his grace to devote my future life to his divine service. Nor do I conclude that the danger is yet over, unless God in his mercy either remove our enemy or heal the breach. But if we should be called again to action, I hope to have the courage and strength to act my part valiantly in defense of our liberties and country." One of the more notable men who remained inside the redoubt as the American troops fled was Joseph Warren. As he parried British bayonets with his ceremonial sword, he was sadly shot in the head and was instantly killed. A 2011 forensic analysis, spearheaded by the very talented and all-around nice guy Dr. Samuel Foreman, revealed that Warren had been shot with a small-caliber weapon, either a pistol or an officer's fusil. His body was stripped of its clothing, and he was bayoneted until unrecognizable, and then shoved into a shallow ditch. British Captain Walter Laurie later stated he stuffed the scoundrel with another rebel into one hole, and there he and his seditious principles may remain. In a letter to John Adams, Benjamin Hitchborn describes how a British Lieutenant James Drew of the sloop HMS Scorpion allegedly desecrated Warren's body 2 days after the battle. In a day or two after, Drew went up on the hill again, opened the dirt that was thrown over Dr. Warren, spit in his face, jumped on his stomach, and at last cut off his head and committed every act of violence upon his body. In the aftermath of the engagement, the British had taken the ground, but at a great loss. They had suffered 1,054 casualties, 226 dead, and 828 wounded, with a disproportionate number of these officers. British dead and wounded included 100 commissioned officers, a significant portion of the British officer corps in North America. General Clinton would remark in his diary, "A few more such victories would have shortly put an end to the British dominion in America." Another British officer would observe, "We have learned one truth, which is that the Americans, if they are equally well commanded, are full as good soldiers as ours." The colonial losses were about 450, of whom 140 were killed. Most of the losses came during the withdrawal at the end of the battle. Back in London, the casualty counts alarmed the military establishment and forced many to rethink their views of colonial military capability. King George's attitude towards the colonies hardened, and the news may have contributed to his rejection of the Continental Congress's Olive Branch Petition, the last political attempt at reconciliation. In July, General George Washington arrived in Cambridge to assume command of the new Continental Army and to direct the ongoing campaign at Boston. General Gage was eventually recalled to London to answer for the outcome of the battles of Lexington and Concord, as well as the Battle of Bunker Hill. General Howe, the field commander at the Battle of Bunker Hill, assumed command of the British forces in Boston. Howe was unwilling to repeat another disaster he witnessed firsthand at Bunker Hill, and General Washington lacked the supplies to mount any offensive. Thus, the siege of Boston devolved into a stalemate. It would not be until March of 1776 that the siege came to an end. After acquiring over 50 pieces of artillery from Fort Ticonderoga during the winter, General Washington ordered his men to fortify Dorchester Heights to the south of Boston overnight. This position proved even more formidable than the one at Charlestown, and Howe ultimately decided to evacuate Boston instead. I hope you have enjoyed today's episode of Historical Nerdery. To learn more about the Battle of Bunker Hill, as well as other neat information about Revolutionary New England, be sure to check out my website, historicalnerdery.com, follow me on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my mailing list. I'm Alex Kane, and this has been Historical Nerdery.